From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. During a legislative session, one issue always seems to rise to the top and become a kind of label for that year, the year of education or the year of liquor laws or whatever. And it's not to say this year didn't have interesting moments, but a lot of observers say things on Capitol Hill seemed subdued. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune called it the session of the living dead. He says there were message bills and pet projects, but there just didn't seem to be the usual passion. Still, plenty happened this year, of course. Today in the program, we're talking about some of it. Not as many message bills, but you did have guns and Medicaid expansion and relocating the prison. And of course, there is the budget and education and clean air. We're looking back on the session today, talking about what happened and what didn't. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Subdued was the word we've been hearing as a way to describe this year's legislative session, which ended late last week. Just why is one of the things we'll be talking about today. It may have had something to do with the fact that the session featured one of the largest freshman classes in 20-odd years, and so some legislators were probably still feeling their way around the process. Still, plenty did happen this year. We're going to be talking about the political atmosphere today, how so many new faces anyway changed the dynamic of all of this. There did not seem to be as many message bills this year, but you did have your flare-ups on guns, on Medicaid expansion, on ethics, on relocating the prison. And, of course, there are also the matters of the budget and education and clean air. We're looking back on the session today, talking about what happened and what didn't happen. And we hope you'll join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Terry Gilday is our news director, KUER's news director, joining us again. Terry, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
Marianne Martindale is with us again, also the executive director of Alliance for a Better Utah. It's an organization that advocates for progressive issues at the legislature. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Holly Richardson back with us also, a conservative blogger and former state representative. Her blog is called Holly on the Hill. She's tweeting, as a matter of fact, as we speak. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
Robert Gerke is back with us also, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, so I mentioned, I guess, right here at the introduction, subdued. But give me your own words. Those may be the words you're actually using, but how would you characterize the session so far this year? Terry Gilday, start with you.
Well, it wasn't a session that started out. There was, you know, education and other issues that were sort of permeating the session, and then other issues seemed to take over: guns, air quality, Medicaid at the last minute, and the ethics, the questionable ethics perhaps of our attorney general and who would investigate him in a situation of that nature. So I think lawmakers walking into it thought that X, Y, and Z were going to be important, and then A, B, and C became important. And we saw Democrats introducing air quality bills right in the beginning of the session when there was a heightened sense that that was going to sort of permeate the session with all the protests and situations going on there. And then the national attitude in Washington looking at potential gun control, we found several bills that popped up right there at the beginning. So it wasn't what people expected it would be.
Mm-hmm. So, Robert, I stole your term, session of the living dead. But that's sort of how you saw it in some way.
Well, I mean, it just didn't have a sense of vitality or passion to it, I don't think, from what I saw. And I've been doing a number of these for a number of years. Part of it, I think you hit on, it was the new members. I think that's they take some time to learn the ropes. Their bills take a while to get written, you know, and so some of that stuff didn't come out until the end. I think there were a number of other reasons. I think leadership, new leadership in the Senate probably had something to do with it. As Terry mentioned, I think the biggest protests or demonstrations you saw this session were over the air quality issue. And that's one that it sort of, once the air cleared, the furor kind of died down a little bit, I think. So some of the more, you know, the issues that were really going to fire people up sort of either got, you know, quietly dealt with behind closed doors, or, you know, with the exception of the gun issue, I think that one is one that sort of was more or less hashed out. The bills died in the Senate, the two bills that Representative Green and Representative Ray's bill. But there just wasn't a lot for people to get exercised about. And so as a result, things sort of, you know, went at a fairly leisurely kind of calm pace. Yeah. And then the budget issues, I think, too, because there was uncertainty about what sequestration was going to do, what the revenue figures were going to look like at the coming into the session. They had to kind of put everything on hold for a while. And then when they came in, they were good but not great. So people got some of what they wanted but not everything. And everybody kind of walked away going, well, okay, that's the end of the session, I guess. Mm. So anyway, that's my take on
it. Well, we'll talk about the particulars as we go. Holly, what do you think?
Yeah, same kind of thing. And as you mentioned in the introduction, normally we have the ability to say this was, you know, the 10th Amendment year, states' rights year, education, and there just wasn't a defining thing. In fact, I had people yesterday, my neighbors, asking me, well, you know, the session's over, what'd you think? And I said, well, I was happy about the hair braiding exemption thing, but I can't even really describe anything that really stood out a lot. I mean, there was some of the more entertainment, I guess, the last week of the session. It's just fun to watch some of the procedural stuff that happens and, you know, some of the maneuverings that go on. But largely, it was very, very quiet and very subdued. And, you know, there were always a few people who had some dumb comments on the floor and other places. But overall, I thought it was very quiet. And just they went there, they got to work, they did some things that have needed to be done for a while. They looked at education and funding and boring is also a good word.
Marianne, is this how it's supposed to work?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I mean, it's certainly not as glamorous. It doesn't have that sex appeal like, you know, sex ed last year was a lot more exciting.
Yeah.
It wasn't as good as it could have been. It wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, I think, all of us, no matter what side of the spectrum you're on, we walked away kind of with a little bit of a sigh of relief, like, you know, at least it wasn't horrible or it wasn't great, you know. And the budget thing, as Robert was talking about, sort of turned out to be kind of much ado about nothing. It was a lot of scare right at the front and a lot of rhetoric about, oh, we've got to wait. We don't know what's going to happen with the budget. And it turned out to not really be much of an impact on what they did. They didn't fund some things. They funded a lot of things. They gave the 2% increase to education. And, you know, so it really wasn't – it could have been worse. That's what I always look for.
That sounds like a progressive speaking. Do you find yourself saying that sometimes? Or, I mean, I guess that's your takeaway, right?
I do often, unfortunately. Yeah. I'm like, well, it wasn't, you know, because there are a lot of things that we were watching that just never materialized. There was a lot of threats of things, you know. You never quite know what a boxcar bill is, you know, what they're holding something back for. And we just didn't see a lot of that materialize. In the end, we saw about the only bill that we saw come out of nowhere was the hijack of the Medicaid one, which I'm sure you'll probably get to.
We will.
And
then
the very last day suspension of every rule known to pass the bill about Attorney General.
Yeah.
But you didn't even complain. Amazing.
I spoke in favor of it.
Imagine that. Well, we'll get to those. But let me ask you. So it is interesting. I think this the kind of churn or the turnover is interesting.
Yeah.
As I said at the introduction, the biggest freshman class in something like 20 years or whatever it is. So how is that changing the equation? I mean, I guess we don't know because they're still, as we said, feeling their way around. But are we seeing new leaders emerge, new sort of charismatic players, new sort of odd, nutty players, if you know what I mean?
All of the above.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'll make a prediction right now, and I don't know if anybody else will back me up on this, but I suspect that the 2014 cycle will see one of the lowest amounts of turnover in quite some time. I mean, I think it will go from a very large percentage in the 2012 cycle to a very low percentage in the 2014 cycle, especially if you take out the people who naturally, by attrition, decide they're not going to run again. I suspect we're going to have low turnover. But
why?
Well, really, because I think of this session was not polarizing on either side. And
so there's, you didn't tick too many people off.
Exactly. Yeah. No matter who you were. And no matter at top of the ticket, the only potential big race right now that I think we're looking at is the Mia Love Jim Matheson potential rematch. And other than that, there's no big, huge draw, right? Obama's not running. There's no Romney on the ticket. There's none of that. And so I suspect we're going to see a very mild 2014 session.
Less posturing.
You know, yeah. Yeah. Barring, you know, unforeseen dramatic events on the national level. So I thought that there were some freshmen who stood out. I think a lot of them were very, very good to be freshmen. And by that, I mean to be quiet, mostly the session to learn process. Some of them are brand, brand new to the political process. Some of them have been involved in other forms, whether they were mayors or county commissioners or, you know, other things. And so they knew process, even though it's a different environment. Some of them were so new, they didn't know what pro tem meant.
But what it means, the CERCLA bill.
Yes, exactly. But instead of standing standing up and, you know, making fools of themselves. They sat back and they learned, which is actually, I think, a good idea for freshmen in general.
This is probably dangerous for me to say without having the data to back it up. But I think over the last few years, you've seen sort of a moderating of this legislature, because you've seen a lot of the Patrick Henry caucus people, some of the people that were sort of the firebrands up there for a number of years, have run for other offices or moved on to other things. And the people who've replaced them have been a little bit more of a libertarian bent, you know, so they don't want the government intervention in the same way that maybe some of the socially conservative legislators might. And so I think you've seen, as a result of that, a sense that this legislature wants the government to do less. And as a result, you don't end up with a lot of the bills that kind of have raised a lot of it, drawn a lot of attention in the past, where the government's going to be, you know, perceived to be overreaching. I have a sense that might continue on. I don't see any sign that it's going to the pendulum's going to swing the other way. And I think you also, you know, you've seen some of the younger people. They're not younger people, but some of the newer people taking on, you know, prominent roles. You had, on the Senate side, you had Senator Niederhauser as president. He's only been up there for 6 years. Senator Adams was in leadership. A senator, you know, he's only been there, I think, 4 years, Holly?
Six.
So, and then you had Dean Sampe, who was the rules chairman over on the House side, who's almost, you know, he's a sophomore, I guess. And so, you do have some of these young people sort of taking more prominent roles, but also I think a tone of this legislature sort of taking a little bit more of a tempered, moderate approach than some of the past sessions.
I was just going to say, I felt President Niederhauser sort of seized the mantle of leadership in the Senate. I mean, and he really wanted to make the trains run on time there. And right at the beginning, he was making sure that members were on the floor for a 10 a.m. floor session right away. He was scolding members for being 5-10 minutes late. And so he really stepped up in that role, I thought.
What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think something that Robert...
To Robert's moderating idea.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I think Robert's point, although it's interesting because I don't think that necessarily all of their policies are more moderate. I think what we're seeing is a moderation of social policies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those are the things that tend to get the public's attention. So, you know, you have less of the, let's get rid of Planned Parenthood, let's, you know, 10-week abortion ban. You don't have, you know, the anti-gay things. And so it's a little bit different.
I think that libertarian bent then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it doesn't make me less concerned about some of the policies, because there's still a lot of policies that I don't necessarily agree with, or I'm concerned about some of the tax directions. But they're certainly harder to sell to the public. Those are the things that really is the sausage making.
Those are, and Marianne's right. That's what I was speaking to, those issues that sort of grab headlines and draw people's attention and get people protesting up there. You know, I think from a fiscal policy standpoint, I think they're as conservative as they've ever been.
Mm-hmm. The Zion Curtain thing seems to plug into that, does it not?
It does. That really put both houses at odds.
Let's explain what we mean. Robert, just sort of give us a quick sense.
Well, so in 2009, the part of the reform package that they passed was included that new restaurants had to have this 7-foot-tall barrier that obscures or obstructs from public view the pouring or mixing of drinks. So if you're pouring a beer, mixing a cocktail, pouring a glass of wine, it has to be done behind this curtain. And the reason behind that at the time it was expressed is that we don't want children to be seeing drinks poured or mixed, because it would encourage consumption. Some of the new people in the House that are more libertarian, I think, and Representative Ryan Wilcox in particular, ran this legislation that would get rid of that, because he said, you know, all these old bars or all these old restaurants are grandfathered in. They don't have to have this wall. The new ones, it's a burden for them, you know, in terms of their floor plan and business model and whatever. And so let's just get rid of it. You know, it doesn't – there's no proof, he said, that it actually works. It passed the House, I think, pretty overwhelmingly. I think it was 60-something to 11. And it goes over to the Senate, and it just dies there, because the senators are convinced that that this barrier reduces the incidence of youth drinking and service of alcohol. So it really did put him at odds, because the Senate is convinced that this is an effective policy, and the House is convinced that it's not, and it's, again, going to their libertarian bent, that it's government doing something that they don't necessarily need to be doing.
Well, inside that bill, too, they approved a provision which allowed for restaurants to have a master license now. So one restaurant can have one license and serve alcohol at several locations. But it's my sense that they want to get some larger national chain restaurants into Utah. Yet, so they go with a master license, then they have this barrier, literally, the Zion Curtain, which – so if a larger fine dining national chain wants to come in here, they've got to construct this wall where – restaurants that have been grandfathered out of this since 2009 don't have to. So you're really running into this, again, this collision of sort of small business-minded Republicans who want to attract more business to Utah and other folks who feel that sometimes morality or their sense of morality trumps business.
So it's Marianne, it's the House that's tempering the sensibility
in some of
this
that,
time?
Definitely. I mean, you saw a lot of issues get passed through the House, but I mean alcohol is a perfect contradiction. I mean, that bill is a contradiction in and of itself. You know, this free market, pro-business approach that so many are taking, and that the Senate and the House have both touted for years, it's a contradiction in that very bill. They keep this one element that there's no statistics. There's nothing that proves that this has done anything to reduce underage drinking. It doesn't. They can't point to a single thing except their own gut or their own instinct or whatever it is that they want to say. But yet on the same, they're trying to open up this master license to allow for these larger chains. And it just doesn't even make any sense. So it's frustrating because you saw the House step back from that and say, this is ridiculous. This doesn't do anything. It's not providing any kind of recourse for underage drinking. It's just a problem for businesses. And then the Senate wouldn't concede.
Well, what I think was interesting was to hear the conversation that Ryan Wilcox had as they refused to recede or refused to concur with the Senate amendments that came over. And they went to the conference committee, and Ryan said, Representative Wilcox said, that they offered stricter penalties for DUI, stronger enforcement of inappropriate either selling to underage mm-hmm. drinkers or the drunk driving, and the Senate absolutely refused to go there. They just wanted to keep that curtain up. And I'm one of the Marianne calls me a Republican because and she's right, because I want to be limited government across the scope, not limited government unless I believe I should enforce my views on you by law, which I think Robert rightly pointed out, we have less of that now in the House. And so the House, it was quite interesting. And even on the last night when they did the kind of post-session party or celebration.
Shenanigans.
They had a big Zion curtain, right? And it was a shower curtain, and they wrote Zion across the top, and they kept wanting to put it up and down between the piano player. And then they had Representative Wilcox, you know, come tear down this curtain, right? Well, Mr. Wilcox.
Well, and
down
from the
curtain.
Floor, they called it. They said, this is weird. Yeah. I mean, they're acknowledging true. Themselves. This is weird. But it makes us look strange.
But I guess I'm surprised by the Senate, because you would have thought, since Senator Wadops is gone now.
Yeah. But Valentine is not gone.
Right. Okay. So there are still the forces.
He's carrying the mantle.
Is that the idea?
Senator Valentine seemed to be the barrier between mm-hmm. the Zion mm-hmm. curtain coming down and not coming down.
Mm-hmm. When he speaks on these issues, they listen to him, I think. Because he does have a lot of experience in writing liquor legislation. Senator Wadops being gone, according to the Restaurant Association, had an impact on some of the what they referred to as the common sense reforms, the master license and so forth, getting passed. Holly mentioned that the speaker on several occasions called it weird, and at one point in the after party, I guess, made a crack about how the Senate, or she referred to them as the state presidents, had rejected that bill, which I thought was entertaining. I don't know if that caused some gnashing of teeth at some tall building downtown, but I think this is, as Representative Wilcox said at the end of the session, this is, smaller than baby steps you take in this state and in this culture.
Go ahead, Robert.
No, he said he's going to continue to pursue this going forward.
I wanted to say something about the Lockhart crack, because it seems like – do you all see that as some sort of kind of refreshing sense of irony being imposed into something that you didn't maybe talk about in the past?
It's really nice to see them calling it like they see it. You know, in the past, we haven't seen that as much. There's been a deferential sort of conversation back and forth between the two houses. And when you're up there, you see a lot more of the challenging going on in the conversation. But it's different to hear it from the floor. And I think it's encouraging. I liked that the speaker was that honest about it and that the other members. It is encouraging.
I want to get a sense of power plays I've been hearing a lot about power plays. And it's intriguing. You think about the speaker, Becky Lockhart. She's not going to run next time. And there's some talk, and I want to get some sense about what you think is going to play out. There's some sense that Congressman Jason Chaffetz is going to be running for governor in some way, and that Becky Lockhart will then fill that role or will run at least for Congress, which raises the question of what's the dynamic going on now between Governor Herbert, he hasn't given any indication whether he'll run again, but we don't know whether he's not. Mm-hmm. So what are the power plays that you're seeing up there? Holly, you start.
There's some, right? There's some. And in terms of political lifespan, 3 years down the road from now is quite a long time. Yeah. And it's very difficult to really project what's going to happen. So I think there's some interest on the speaker's part of looking at a different office 2 years from now. So she won't run in 2014, but potentially in 2016. It could be for Congress. It could be for governor. It could be that she decides she's going to, you know, and this is pure speculation, but that maybe she'll take up a lobbying gig. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know, right? Greg Curtis has done that. And there's been a few who've taken up lobbying after they've done their time in the House. But there are always power plays. There's power plays within each body. There are power plays between the two bodies. There's power plays between the governor's office. And I think that's healthy. I think it's healthy to have some good tension. And frankly, I look at sometimes the federal government and think that's part of why we have complete gridlock, is because we don't have clear boundaries anymore between which role has the executive branch versus legislative versus judicial. And so you have one party sometimes saying, look, that's not even your role. And so we're going to dig in our heels on this one issue because you've bled over now. And I think we've got some healthy tension. And I don't know that it's bad. I don't see a lot of name calling. And, you know, as long as you can take a step back and say, this is not personal, this is about policy, it's not about personalities, you know, it's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah. What do you think?
I agree. I think the tension is actually a positive. The difference is it seems to be playing out more in a public sphere this year than we've seen. You know, you had at the very beginning of the session, you had the Speaker of the House actually sort of draw the line in the sand over the veto issue with the governor. And we haven't really seen that before. You know, she actually kind of called him on it. But, you know, I mean, that's the
system. And we should explain. She asked him to do more vetoing.
Specifically, yeah. Yes. She said he should be vetoing more legislation. And that's an interesting thing. But, you know, I mean, that's the way this is created. We have the House, we have the Senate, we have the governor. I mean, we have three steps for that. There's a checks and balance process to creating legislation, and there should be. And there shouldn't just be, one person came up with it, and it should just slide through without any sort of consideration. I mean, I think the tension is good, and I hope it makes for better legislation.
We'll talk about it in the context, Robert, of I think it's House Bill 76, this concealed carry. It passed. The governor wasn't crazy about it, but there's some question about whether or not it passed, and there's a veto-proof majority by which it passed.
Yeah.
But there's some question about what the governor is going to do.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think?
You don't really know that you have a veto-proof majority until you have a veto override session and count the votes, because a lot of those votes may not be there to override a veto if he does. And you know, there's a fair amount of speculation on the Hill that he will veto that bill. There was some pushback. That bill was amended. There were a couple different attempts to amend it that the governor seemed to at least tacitly be supportive of, to, you know, limit the scope of it to rural counties, and to the way they amended it. You can carry a gun, but it can't be loaded, which frankly just means it can't have a bullet in the chamber. So it means there's less chance of accidental discharge, right? And you know, there was some question of whether that bill was going to pass in the House, in the Senate, after the House passed it over. And it not only passed, but it passed fairly comfortably. The governor said, you know, he doesn't think that there's a problem with our current gun laws, and that if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as he's probably said 50 times this session in response to this. and so, you know, it does set up this. It does set up this. Standoff, right? You know, a gun standoff with the Utah legislature. So I think, you know, and I personally saw the governor's hand in more bills this session, I think, than in some previous years. The prison bill was one that he was actively involved in sort of massaging the makeup of that board. And, you know, so I but ultimately, I think the legislature takes a little bit of glee in the fact that they're, you know, for those 45 days, the final word in what passes and what doesn't. And, you know, and they have control over the shape of the legislation that ends up on his desk, and then he can do what he chooses to do.
Terry, what do you think?
Well, just back to HB 76 for a second, because I think it's a really important piece of legislation. It's hard to tell if this bill and Brian Greene's HB 114, the Second Amendment's Protection Act, if those would have been introduced if we didn't have the Newtown Massacre, if we didn't have the possibility of gun control laws in Washington being crafted.
I can't imagine we would have had them if there hadn't been a Newtown. Yeah.
Well, in fairness, though, HB 76 is a constitutional carry bill that's been up here, introduced in the legislature, I think, for the last 3 years. At least the last two.
But it was a weird bill because you had Representative Mathis who said, look, I just want to be able to take my gun out and then put my slicker over
it
I'm riding on the range, which, you know, as he maintains, it had nothing to do whatsoever with Newtown, which was hard to buy, I guess. But I'll let you finish.
Well,
Terry.
I think you saw that a lot in when this bill was first brought to the floor, HB 76, they debated it for about 45 minutes, and then Majority Leader Brad D circled it. Mathis didn't seem really happy about that, but they needed to get behind closed doors, caucus on this, and figure out where this bill was headed, I think. But in the end, it is a very interesting bill, and we'll see what happens. As Robert said, you don't know if it's going to be if there's going to be an override on a veto until you get the votes together and figure it out. I would expect that Governor Herbert will be sitting down with key leaders and deciding, you know, where he needs to go on this.
Terry Gilday is with us, KUER's news director. We have Marianne Martindale, executive director of the Alliance for a Better Utah. Holly Richardson blogs at Holly on the Hill, and Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, looking back on this year's legislative session, didn't seem to be as many fireworks or battles as in the past, but there were some interesting debates. And we're talking about what happened and what didn't today with Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, Marianne Martindale, executive director for the Alliance for a Better Utah, Holly Richardson blogs at Holly on the Hill. She's a conservative blogger, former state representative, and Robert Gerke with us, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Okay, email from Brad, who writes, I was wondering what you think of the last-minute ethics legislation clearly aimed at Attorney General John Swallow. Brad writes, so often we've had ethics concerns involving major players in the legislature that were swept under the rug. Even though Attorney Swallow is a member of the majority party, this came up, interesting, he's suggesting here, to his colleagues not like Mr. Swallow. So let's talk about that, the sort of the ethics legislation. It is interesting. Robert Gerke, you want to start with that?
Well, I think typically with ethics legislation, you end up getting legislation in response to something that you hadn't anticipated before. And so I think that's the case this time. You ended up there had been all of the talk about ethics over the past 5 years, 6 years has been focused on the legislature and their ethics processes. This arose and they realized, well, wait a minute, we don't have any ethics processes for elected statewide officials. And so so they created they basically took the carbon copy of the legislative ethics panel and applied that now to executive branch offices. They are limiting how much sort of moonlighting, the outside work they can do. Again, this is in response to the Swallow incident. And then, as Marianne mentioned at the outset, there was sort of the last-minute scramble to try to as the law was structured, if there was an election campaign law complaint, it was filed to the lieutenant governor, and then the lieutenant governor says, okay, there's merit to this. He would turn it over to the attorney general. Well, they realize, well, if we have the attorney general who's the subject of the complaint, we've got to have some other avenue to investigate this. And so at the last hour, they passed this legislation to have the lieutenant governor appoint a special counsel. But yeah, I think all of these point directly back to flaws or holes or gaps that were in state law as it pertained to those executive branch elected offices, and they tried to tighten some of them down. Again, maybe the cow's out of the barn now, but But they moved to try to deal with some of these for future in future occurrences.
But they waited until the ethics charges came in a different branch of government.
Well, but again, the ethics commission that they created for those executive branch offices is identical to the one that they created for the legislative branch. Was that three years ago?
And that was happening during the session. I mean, this was not the last minute thing. The last minute thing was as a complaint was filed and they looked at it and realized that the process would require that the complaint be investigated by the Attorney General's office. Yeah. Thank you to Marianne. But honestly, there were two pieces of ethics legislation that were worked on the entire session. So there was that one piece with the Ethics Commission and the other piece was the one about no outside consulting.
They were referred to as the swallow effect, however.
Yes, so, they were.
It's great. I mean, we're really pleased with the – especially the one on the last day. I mean, we filed the election complaint the week prior to that. And, you know, that we weren't exactly sure what was going to happen. I mean, obviously they could have let the session just go and then could have had to try to deal with it after the session or done something else or just handed it back to the Attorney General, which would have been ridiculous but possible. So that last minute change was really was a good change. It could go farther. I mean, there's still a lot of, as Robert said, there's a lot of holes in the code. You know, I mean, we've sort of operated under this. Well, but we don't do that sort of thing here, and that's unfortunate because when you don't have the laws for it and you do those things, then you look like you're scrambling to try to cover up the mess that was just created instead of having bills or laws already on the books that actually cover the potential for doing something wrong. As this was the case. I mean, they didn't have any – there's nothing in that code that identifies what happens if a member of the executive branch happens to be the person who is potentially violating the election law.
Well, then one thing that if I might add too is there were three separate bills, I think, to deal with campaign contribution limits. Also, you know, these are sort of perennial bills that keep coming up, but they were brought up this time again directly in relation to the scandal involving the Attorney General, and none of them made it very far. I think the Senate bills didn't get a hearing. I think Representative Powell's bill did get a hearing, but it didn't survive. So there are other things that were not done, I guess, in response to the Swallow incident.
I was just going to say it was an interesting piece of news on the last day. It felt like a lot of things had been wrapped up, and then all of a sudden both chambers were suspending the rules, pushing this bill through quickly. And it was a realization, I think, on a lot of levels that this needed to be done and done fast.
Let's talk about Jake Anderegg, a freshman representative.
Bless his heart.
Can we give him back?
Well, I mean
– No, he's passionate about his issues, including his religion. That's all.
Well, OK. Let's talk about just the role that he's played. And I guess we should mention, Robert, that this sort of – we bring his name up in the context of this question about whether or not – you know, his attempt anyway to strip from the governor the ability to accept or reject the Medicaid expansion.
Right. The way this one played out is near the end of the session, there was a bill that was sponsored by Representative Chavez Houck that would have allowed or I guess not allowed, required the state to expand Medicaid. She got the bill to a hearing and said, look, I put this bill together so we could have the discussion. Let's discuss it over the interim. Here's the fiscal note that we got from it. It's going to save the state $6 million in the first year, et cetera. That panel that included Representative Anderegg passed her bill out, said, well, we'll study it in the interim. You know, we'll do that. And then the next bill up, they amended to prohibit the governor. He said, shall not accept any Medicaid expansion dollars. That same panel voted for it to do that. It created kind of a stir because, you know, the presumption was that the governor was going to – there's a study that's out there that the health department's doing. They're still trying to define, you know, what exactly it would entail to take this Medicaid expansion money. The governor has said he's going to make a decision sometime late this summer probably. And so when Representative Anderegg amended the bill with the support of several of the more conservative members on that panel, it created a bit of a stink. And so, their contention is, the federal government can't actually fulfill its responsibilities or the promises it's making to fund some of this. And so it got toned down. It passed the House. Representative Anderegg gave a passionate floor speech that included quoting scripture and he got weepy. It went over to the Senate. The Senate took some of the teeth out of it. They said, we want to be included. They amended it to say we'll be included in this.
It's still the governor's thing.
It's still the governor's thing. We want access to the studies that are being done, and that's the bill that ultimately got through. So.
It was interesting because, a lot of what they said in the Senate actually was more along the lines of what Representative Chavez-Houck's bill had said, that we need to wait for the study. We need to do our due diligence on this. We really need to research whether or not this is the right fit for Utah. And then ultimately it's the governor's decision with the legislature support. So it was interesting because that sort of went back to what was happening in the committee and undid what Andereg did.
So what do you make of him? Is he going to be one of these types who proposes, sort of the doctrinaire sorts, who proposes a lot of these message bills and connects his ideology to his religion? You see them from time to time on the Hill.
Well, I think that they're always there, whether they are quoting scripture on the floor, which I don't think he'll ever do again.
It's now called Andereging, by the way.
he was smacked down pretty good on that. I don't think he'll ever do that again, actually. I think that's just a freshman mistake, because there's a lot who do. I'm one who does. My religion certainly influences my policies,
sure,
and my view of the appropriate role of a legislature. But, Jake is a good guy, and he's passionate about his issues. I think that you will see him tied fairly closely to, like, Ken Ivory. Their policies and their view of the federal government and state government are very closely aligned, and I think that you'll see, those two working together hand in hand.
Is this a new faction forming in some way?
The new version of the Patrick Henry Caucus. I don't think they'll call themselves that, but yeah. the Tenth Amendment lands, whatever it is. And they're both great guys, passionate about their issues, and I think that this is something that you'll see moving forward. But on the Medicaid expansion, I actually thought it was fun to watch the substitution of the bill. And honestly, it wasn't going to come out of the Senate unless there were some significant changes. And so some significant changes were made and it was passed. But I think it's a way for the legislature to let the governor know that this is not free money and it doesn't come without strings. And this is their opinion.
If the intent was to send a message, I think they did send a message. But one of the more remarkable things that I think came out of it was Senator Niederhauser, in response to it, said, Utah probably won't be the first state to take the Medicaid money, but at the end of the day, we'll take the money because we should get our share if that's the way.
Means what? We don't want to be the first, but if somebody else does, then we.
It means push comes to shove. He thinks that we're going to take the money that's offered.
And the philosophy is too: if you're paying your federal income taxes and that money is being sent now to New Jersey and Florida and not to Utah, then we're paying for a Medicaid program somewhere else. Why not pay for it in our state?
It's a rationale you heard in Florida.
Yeah,
with the governor there.
Yeah,
I'm sure you're here in other places. Let me shift gears a bit to clean air. It's something that we've been talking about on this program over the past couple of weeks. We got an email this morning from Steve who asks about one particular bill I've been trying to follow, HB 96, the Clean Car Bill. I know it went for a third reading on the Senate. Did the bill pass? He wants to know. So does anyone know the particulars of that one? Whether or not you know the particulars of that one, Terry, I'll start with you.
Sure.
Generally, to what happened with clean air.
Well, the bill that the emailer is talking about, HB 96, is Representative Jack Draxler's clean fuel tax incentives, and it was pared down to include compressed natural gas vehicles, propane vehicles, and electric vehicles. It did pass. It sort of geared to favor CNG over propane or electric, and we can get into that a little bit more. There's
That's natural gas.
That's natural gas. Compressed natural gas. There's a bill that sort of goes along with that, SB 275, which is a bill that was proposed by Senator Adams in the Senate. But Republicans had been working on this legislation, and the governor came out in support of it about 10 days before the session when it was released. That, I'll try not to be so complicated with it, but it basically sets up a loan program for municipalities to convert their fleet vehicles to compressed natural gas and opens up, gives Questar some incentives to broaden and strengthen the CNG fueling infrastructure. Really, Republicans saw the issues with air quality in the end as an opportunity to push more for the consumption and production of compressed natural gas and the production of CNG in Utah. So that was really the Republican side. There were five bills by Democrats that were proposed earlier on in the session with really without consulting Republicans at all, and only one of those passed. That was Patrice Arendt's HB 168, and it mandates the state agencies to come up with a plan to reduce pollution. Now, there's no fiscal note with that bill. Representative Arendt said when the plans come back, then the state's Economic Development Task Force will look at what plans cost what and try to make some decisions on that end. But there were bills that were proposed by Representative Briscoe and Polson to pay for mass transit passes in the months of January and July, to provide tax incentives for those who buy mass transit passes. Rebecca Chavez-Houck had a bill that would allow Utah to clean up its air beyond EPA standards. All of these died in committee or failed.
The interesting thing about the Adams bill going forward to what is going to be this, while the legislature didn't raise taxes for you know, clean air, you know, to clean up the air, they gave the Public Service Commission the authority to assess fees for these municipalities. Not just municipalities either. We're talking if a school district wants to convert its bus fleet to natural gas, they can go get a loan from this loan fund. And ratepayers, Questar ratepayers, are going to be paying into that up to I think a dollar a month, if I remember right. And so this is where I think the rubber is going to hit the road, and Utahns are going to be asked, do we want to pay a little bit more to maybe try to clean up the air a little bit? And that's a pretty fundamental question that this session I don't think got a lot of attention. I don't think they were actually proposing many proposals that were saying, well, let's put an assessment on carbon, or to, you know, on you know, put, invest some money into a cleaner fuels. So but I think down the road, you know, we'll see how that one plays out. I mean, I think UTA is going to be one of the entities that's going to be coming to the PSC looking for some money on that, out of that loan fund, to try to convert some of their bus fleet. So we'll see what the impact is of that.
Marian, what did you think about all that? There was not one filed bill related to air quality at the beginning of the session.
It was pretty interesting to watch this play out. And, you know, we started about the first halfway through the session, all of a sudden the air cleared, and it really did almost lose its impetus. You know, it's like the conversation just stopped up there, which is what happens. You know, when you're able to breathe, you don't think so much about the air. I did think it was very interesting that the Republican bills that passed were all essentially pro-natural gas industry-related bills. The Democrats' bills didn't even get out of committee. They barely even got discussion, you know, with the exception of Patrice Arendt's air quality mitigation report, which you talked about. You know, we're going to have to do something about it. It's a problem. It's not just the cars on the road, but it is the cars on the road, too. You know, we had things like the HOV lane change. We had the speed limit increase. I mean, those are things that actually can impact air quality on the roads. And we went the other direction on those. And I think that I think we really have got to step back and take a broader look at these, not just with industry related and not just with, gee, this is a big Democrat proposal to give away a bunch of free bus passes. But what can we really do, industry and people?
I actually did a blog on air quality and
anxious to hear what you have to say as a libertarian / Republican.
Republican.
You know, it's interesting because I do sometimes hear Republicans say, well, there's nothing we can do. The only thing we can do is either put a big fan on top of the mountain or move the mountains, right? Neither one of which is actually feasible. And there are a lot of things that we can do. There are things that we can do with carpool lanes and actually carpooling. But there's also the fact that UTA made it harder for people to take the bus, to take mass transit. They decreased their routes. They decreased the number of times per day that they're driving a route, right? So my husband's commute time from where we live in Pleasant Grove to downtown Salt Lake almost doubled, from an hour on an express bus to 2.5 hours some days to get the bus over to the tracks, to take it up and catch connections to get back over to where he works. That's really not, you know, conducive to wanting to take mass transit. So, yes, there are things we can do, absolutely. And I think it's hard to keep it sustained when you can look out like today and see it's beautiful and it's clear and the inversion is gone, and that twice a year we have an inversion, you know, once in the winter and it's once in the
July,
summer?
Is it
July? Yeah. And otherwise, a lot of times, honestly, we just forget that it's an issue and we shouldn't.
Holly Richardson with us, blogs at Holly on the Hill. Marian Martindale with us, Executive Director of Alliance for a Better Utah. Terry Gilday is our news director. He's joining us here along with Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're looking back at this year's legislative session with Terry Gilday, KUER's news director, Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, Holly Richardson, blogs at Holly on the Hill, and Marianne Martindale, executive director of Alliance for a Better Utah. And Marianne, just as we barely went on the air, she said we should talk about the prison. So let's do.
SB 72.
SB 72.
Get ready. It's coming. It was interesting. I mean,
It is coming.
It passed, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And the thing is, the bill that was released, so the very first bill that came out, everyone was up in arms and everyone said, this is not right. And I've said this before. I mean, I was an English major, so I know math is not my strong suit. But if you're going to make $100 million off the property and it's going to cost you $500 million to build the prison, there's a $400 million gap in the middle of that. And this, you know, pretend tax windfall that's not based on anything that we've been able to really see – I just don't buy it, and I think that the taxpayers are going to be left holding the boat. But here's the thing that happened with that bill. Throughout the entire session, it just kept getting amended and amended and amended. I mean, it literally had 8 amendments by the time it was over. And at the end of it, it went back to pretty much the original bill, and everyone was so excited because they'd gotten rid of all the worse amendments. And so I left that stooping.
So you ended up where you started?
So I'm still really upset that bill passed because I was just as mad on the last day that it passed as I was on the first day when it was announced, because it's the same bill. No matter what you do, you know, the dirt road that you take to get back to the same originally bad bill, that's what we landed with. And I'm a taxpayer, and I'm not excited about this.
Robert Gerke, where do you think it's headed, this issue?
Well, I mean, I think sitting through some of the Prison Relocation Commission meetings for the past year, you sensed a real frustration that they didn't really understand what they were supposed to be doing, and they had no resources with which to do it. I think the governor sort of told them what they're supposed to be doing on the opening night when he gave his State of the State speech, and he said it's time to move the prison. Now you're going to create a commission to study moving it, I guess. They touted these numbers, 40,000 jobs and $20 billion of economic growth. Those numbers are a little bit questionable because we don't know the source for those numbers. They haven't been reviewed. They came from the people who are interested in moving it. So, you know, I think they'll spend a year. They have $1 million over the next year to
look into it.
They can issue an RFP. They can't award a contract. And one of the interesting debates that occurred in the House, again, this goes back to the libertarian bend, I think, that we talked about a little bit earlier, was whether or not to let private prison companies operate the prison.
And Representative Mike Noel.
Mike Noel, whose son happens to be Beaver County Sheriff, so he runs a big jail down there. But he made the motion to prohibit private prison companies from operating this. He said we shouldn't be incarcerating people at the lowest cost to the lowest bidder. And the House agreed with that, and then it got taken out in the Senate, and the bill that passed ultimately will allow private prison companies for now. I mean, that's a discussion they can have down the road again later, but for now they're still able to do that. That will be an interesting topic of discussion, I think, going forward too.
I want to ask about education. Give us a sense of what happened or didn't happen in terms of the education funding this year.
Well, I thought it was positive, right? I mean, there's never enough money for education. And certainly people say we need more, we need more, we need more. But this year we actually were – the legislature was actually able to appropriate more money. And I think in ways that there are a number of people who are happy about, you know, some of the direction it's going. And
There are a couple of elements, I think, to the way they appropriated it. One is, they appropriated additional money, 2% increase for the WPU this year that they – which is more than they were able to do last year, and that allocation to their per pupil spending had actually been shrinking because they hadn't been able to keep up with the growth as the economy was collapsing. So this is the first year they've actually been able to go to that level. The second thing was everybody loved STEM this year, science, technology, engineering, math, and there was a lot of money put into STEM programs. And there's still not a lot of definition to those programs. And so I think that's going to be watching that sort of coalesce or solidify, I think, over the next little while is going to be something to keep an eye on. And the third thing, I think, is there were an awful lot of technology-specific bills that were run to allocate $1 million here or $5 million there for specific technology-related programs, you know. So we have to watch those carefully too, because those oftentimes in the past have been focused on specific vendors who have a specific product that they get legislation run and then get taxpayer funding for it. So we have to watch the efficacy and how those contracts are awarded.
We've got a minute left, so let me ask you another. Go back to players now. I mean, there's been some concern, I think, among Democrats in this state that the Democrats in the legislature, Democratic leaders in general, have not been assertive enough. And now you have the emergence of Jim DeBacchus, who's now in the Senate. What role is he playing? Marianne Martindale, I'll start with you. We don't have a lot of time, but what role is he playing? And is he making Democrats there more assertive than they have been in the past?
I've been pleasantly surprised by Senator DeBacchus's demeanor in the Senate. I teasingly refer to him as an arm flailer. He knows that. I tease him directly about that. And he didn't have that. You know, it's been an interesting gem to see up there on the Hill. And I think he's been good. He's really reached across the aisle. He's made some great relationships. And he stands and he talks about issues that he's passionate about. And he's informed himself about the bills that he speaks on. And we have seen a rather quiet Senate on the Dem side sometimes. And so it's been refreshing. And he hasn't been polarizing at all, which has been – it's been great.
Yeah, I agree. He's been much more subdued than I expected he would be. Although if you follow him on Twitter, that seems to be where he does a little bit more of the pokey in the eye kind of stuff.
More flailing.
More flailing.
But yeah, I thought he was good. And he was very, very well behaved for a freshman.
Well, and at the end of the session after they'd adjourned, he thanked the Republicans for being what he said was fair to them. He said, I think his words were the lion doesn't have to negotiate with the lamb, but you guys have been reasonable and fair with me. He's got a reputation for being a bomb thrower, but he's always throws those bombs with a smile on his face.
Well, his first piece of legislation was a resolution to protect Greater Canyonland. So it got, you know, it was an important issue in people's minds, but it wasn't something that was over the top.
Terry Gilday, thanks very much for being with us, Terry.
Thanks, Doug.
Robert Gerke, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you. Marianne Martindale, executive director of Alliance for Better Utah.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And Holly Richardson, new blogs, of course, and Holly on the Hill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.